everybody, and welcome to the latest episode of Indie Film Cafe. This is your host, Paul A. Presenza, otherwise known as the Moo Cow. And joining us tonight, all the way out from Los Angeles, we have, and I'll go ahead and introduce yourselves.
Lila Talbot.
And Bobby Gonzalez.
Yay! We haven't seen you guys since way, way back in the very first episode of season one with Baby Ghost.
Oh, God. Baby Ghost. The memories. The fond memories of Baby Ghost and the Baby Ghost theme song.
I know. It was so much fun. This time around, however, we've got you guys back in town for the 1971 Harry Essex classic, Octoman, which is this very weird eco wandering monster kind of flick that Rick Baker, of all people, helped create and design the suit for him. Oscar winning Rick Baker. This was his first film and his first attempt at special effects. And boy, were they special.
Yes, creatures don't need actual esophagi, just a little dent in the mouth in order to be able to eat.
And a mouth that never actually closes and eyes that never blink. And oh my God, it's so ridiculous. Whew. Okay, so why don't we take a quick break, and then when we come back, after we hear some moo music, we will get into talking about this film.
That sample of water you wanted from the mouth of the river. And more. A lot more. What would you say if I said I had the devil in that canister?
Well, I would say that Mort Stein has got a cockeyed sense of humor.
And we are back. All right, guys. First impressions. Octoman. Lyle, you're first. Go.
Well, it's so difficult to say about this movie because there really are some elements that are pretty amazing. Like, I can't tell if it was by accident or intentional, but some of the lighting design was pretty clever. And, you know, from a filmography standpoint, very aesthetically appealing to see. However, there were a lot of points in the movie that just sort of jumped around, and then it was kind of assumed we knew things. And the science was way, way off. So, yeah, I have so many questions.
I completely understand. Bobby, what about you? What do you think?
I'm going to start with the pros, and because it'll be a short list, but an important list. So I want to thank some people. The cinematographer, I would like to thank. That was actually, like, as far as the way things were shot, was pretty lovely. As well as the light design, as Lila said, also really well done. I'd also like to thank the location manager, because some of the shots and some of the places that they filmed were actually really pretty and really beautiful to look at. I think whoever, you know, created the story, I think there was actually like a lot there that made sense. I mean, at the end of the day, concepts can be amazing. It's execution where everything will either fall apart or come together.
Sure.
And some of the dialogue was actually pretty good. That I was actually a little surprised. There was like, you know, like a couple of exchanges here and there of like a philosophical nature where I was like, okay.
Yeah,
sure, bud.
Well, yeah, there's definitely, especially some of the environmental kind of message that, I mean, because in the 70s, that was like the beginning of the environmental movement, the late 60s, early 70s, and it definitely carries over some of that message into today. You know, had we listened 30 freaking years ago, 40 years ago, maybe we wouldn't be in the mess that we're in. And this is a movie that is part of that, because there was a wave of eco/monster movies in the 70s, and this is
only we listened to Octoman. The world would be in a better place had we listened to Octoman.
Sampling of blood taken from these primitive people, whose main diet is seafood, fish, provides evidence that chemical changes produced by underwater detonations of atomic materials have been carried by tides and currents to all parts of the world.
See, there you go, and his little squeaking octo buddies.
Of this tale.
I don't see Octoman as the villain. Yeah. I know I don't in a lot of these films that we cover, but I really don't see Octoman as a villain. I didn't know. I also, is it an Octoman or an Octomom? I don't know. I still dream. And so I think that's important.
So you touched on the pluses. So what about the minuses?
All right. So a lot of Italians trying to do their best to do Spanish accents was rough. I don't know if the female lead was supposed to be an American woman doing an Italian accent or an Italian woman trying to do a Mexican accent. I don't know what's going on there. Either way, it was hard to understand several things that she said, even after several rewinds. And like some of the things that she said seemed really plot relevant. And I was like, what does she say? I don't know, but the plot is moving forward. The suit was rough, but you know, in the dark, it didn't look so bad.
There you go, that's a plus.
Yeah, also just, there's a lot of, my suspension of disbelief, I was definitely suspended somewhere near the moon. I had to be that high in order to actually make the logic jumps required to just get there. How a ring of fire sucks out oxygen outside of a Flash comic book, I don't know.
Yeah.
So I don't even know what else to say. That's there we go. That's me.
All right. Well, let me get in a little bit of the background about where this movie came from and who was involved with this particular film. So as I said, this is a 1971 film, and it was directed by Harry Essex. Now, Harry Essex is famous because he started off as a newspaper writer, and then he ended up becoming a screenwriter for Columbia Pictures. And he's the guy who actually wrote Creature from the Black Lagoon. So if you're seeing a lot of similarities, there you go. He's kind of ripping off himself, really, especially with the whole monster getting fascinated with the female character and picking her up and wandering around.
Didn't set that up at all. There was no problem. It was a King Kong relationship, but like I understood why King Kong wanted the blonde. I didn't understand this. It was just like, oh, hi, with my weird fractal eyes, I see a woman. Clearly, I'm going to take her back to the lake to do.
He was trolling for what he could get. So he wrote Creature from the Black Lagoon. He also wrote It Came from Outer Space, which was, back in the day, was an okay kind of a science fiction one. And then he did other stuff like Kansas City Confidential, a couple other stinkers that are out there. He also wrote for television. He did episodes for Dragnet, for Bat Masterson, for The Untouchables, 77 Sunset Strip, and I, Dream of Jeannie. So he was actually in the biz a good long time, and he did a lot of stuff. Not that a lot of stuff was really great. So a couple of other his movies includes The Cremators. And so I think I mentioned that there was a 40th anniversary movie set that was done. And when it was released packaged with The Cremators, which is a really weird movie. It's like this, it's like a ball of fire that rolls around. It actually rolls around and it rolls on top of people and burns them up. It's very strange.
I like that. I'm here for
good.
That. Yeah.
Because I saw years ago, I saw both these movies when I was a kid. But when I get my hooves on a copy of Cremators, we'll probably end up doing that on the show somewhere along the line.
If you don't tell them how much that Blu-ray set is worth, I will, because that number blew me away.
Right. He was also the writer and director for a film called I, the Jury, which was Mickey Spillane project back in 1958. So he's... You know, Harry Essex actually had, you know, he was in the biz and was a name for a while. However, for whatever reason, he really, really thought that an image of a guy walking around in this sushi outfit or this calamari outfit was going to be frightening. And if you notice, you know, some movies, if they know the monster is going to look ridiculous, they shadow it or they keep it in, you know, in the dark. You see this thing pretty much from the go, and you see it the entire time.
In full daylight
for darkness and darkness for daylight and
yeah.
All the mix-ups that was going on there. It was
babies were cute, though. I liked the babies. Those things were cute.
I'm going to actually jump in here and say that I didn't necessarily hate the suit. Because a lot of like renderings of Cthulhu can be an octopus-like creature that has legs like a man and walks around on those two legs. So, you know, maybe if he was going for a little bit more of a sci-fi effect, you know, I don't hate it entirely. It really was just in like the countenance of the suit that I really was kind of like, you're not even going to move the lips or the eyes or anything. I mean, give me a little bit.
Give me a hole for the mouth.
Right. He was very, very plastic. But then if you look carefully, you'll see that each arm would have like a string tied to the other one. So when he moved the one, he would move the other. And when that string was broken, you could tell because the other one was just there, limp. And I imagine they broke that string several times. But
I mean, it's battle damage. He was active.
Oh my God, so many slaps. But we will get to him. Starring in the film, okay, so we talked about Susan Lowry, this is the character played by Pier Angelini, who was an Italian actress, yes. She was best known in 1951. She was in a film called Teresa, which she won a Golden Globe. She was also in a number of other films from the 50s and 60s, The Devil Makes Three, The Last Days of Sodom and Gomorrah. She was in a bunch of TV things. And she was best probably known because she got involved with a number of Hollywood romances. So she was involved with James Dean for a while. She was involved with Kirk Douglas for a while. She ended up marrying Vic Damone, and they had a kid, and then she got divorced and married somebody else. But, you know, that was, you know, she was for 60s and, you know, 50s and 60s, she was kind of one of the minor it girls for a little while.
Well, one of the things that I looked up about her that I found to be interesting is that she died the year that this movie came out.
Not just died.
Like 39 years old.
Yeah.
I'm curious about what came to pass at that, if it was the curse of Octoman or if it was...
It's interesting you bring that up because she had said before that she had no interest in living past 40. And she died of a barbiturate overdose pretty much towards the end of the filming on set. So there are rumors that she committed suicide, but nobody's able to really prove that for certain. All we know is that she died of a barbiturate overdose. Some people say, well, perhaps it was just acute embarrassment after being in this film. But yeah, no. So that was the thing. So this was her last film.
That got dark.
Do we need to like pass it on to someone else to make sure that they watch it so we don't like die also? Like,
is that the thing? Is that
how we yeah. I know.
Are you transferring this movie to us to kill us?
Thankfully, no. I could just link it to somebody, so I'm just going to like text it around.
I mean, it's YouTube, right? You know?
Yeah, I don't think you have to worry about this when people have survived this particular film, just not her. But you're right, though. Her accent is problematic. And, you know, I've watched this film many times, and there are times I still have no idea what she's saying.
He stares at you as if he's got a brain behind his eyes.
Is she trying to have a Mexican accent, or is it an Italian accent? I just don't know. I can't tell.
I don't think she's either. I think she's just using her natural accent, and I don't think anyone's putting any thought as to exactly what her cultural affinity is.
Well, I guess I'm curious because the film seems to take place in Mexico, but they never really delineate specifically where they are, and then they move around from place to place.
Yes, the primitive people who eat fish.
But they're very clearly not Mexican, so.
No, and as a matter of fact, quite a lot of this was filmed in Bronson Canyon in Griffith Park, L.A. It's possible some of it was filmed in Mexico, but I tend to doubt it. I know that this movie had a working budget of $250,000 in 1971. And of all things, believe it or not, they made a profit. They actually ended up making $280,000. So they made a profit of $30,000.
All right.
That's what happens when you have a movie with a message.
There you go. So anyway, that's Pier Angeli. Next up, we have the main male lead, Dr. Torres, who's played by Kerwin Matthews. Now, Kerwin Matthews is an interesting fella because he's been in a whole bunch of stuff. He's probably most famous known. He's Sinbad in The Seventh Voyage of Sinbad.
Oh, okay. I thought he looked familiar.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then he's also in a stinker called Jack the Giant Killer where he's playing Jack.
Oh, my God. I love that movie.
He's in Battle Beneath the Sun, or I'm sorry, Battle Beneath the Earth, and a few other things as well. So,
did you say Battlefield Earth?
No, I wish. Battle Beneath the Earth.
Battle Beneath the Earth, okay.
Yeah, that's a 60s movie. So he's been around. In fact, most of the people involved are B-movie actors of some level or another. Dr. Willard is also in there. He's played by Jeff Morrow, who's also in a bunch of stuff. And he was in, if you've ever seen the Mystery Science Theater movie, This Island Earth, he's in that. He's in a film called The Creature Walks Among Us. And if you guys watch some of our earlier, or listen to some of our early podcasts, he's in The Giant Claw, which is the big giant wooden bird puppet that builds its nest on the Empire State Building.
Because of course it does. Where else are you going to go?
As you do. So he's been in a whole bunch of stinky films. Now, the quote-unquote Indian character, DeVito, he is actually...
Mexican. Now, when you say Indian, do you mean from India or do you mean indigenous?
No, he's referred to in the script as the Indian. And although his name...
Is he a motorcycle?
He's DeVito. Speaking
Spanish. Right. He is played by David Essex, who is Harry Essex's son.
Of course.
He's practically playing in brown face, for God's sakes. He's like the worst version of a Mexican I have ever seen in my entire life.
Yeah,
I mean, he's got this terrible, you know, campesino stereotype outfit and hat. He's walking around humming the Mexican hat dance. Like, this is what Mexican people do, for crying out loud. It's ridiculous. So yeah, he was the ridiculous, stereotypical campesino character. And I wondered what you guys were going to think about that, because I know certainly with Lila can be kind of sensitive to racial portrayals, and this is just, I don't think it was meant to be mean-spirited, but it's definitely flimsy, extremely flimsy.
I'm sensitive to that material. I'm just sensitive to inaccuracy, and like to portray a specific culture or person very poorly. I mean, because obviously in the 70s, there wasn't enough conversation about hiring people of color, or, you know what I mean, hiring specifically Mexican people to play Mexican roles, which we all agree is bullshit and stupid, and hopefully we're moving forward with that kind of stuff. But at the same time, yeah, it really is about accuracy, because if you're going to have someone who's going to have the temerity to play a culture or a race outside of their own, I mean, heck, at least get it right.
At least get the Mexican hat dance song right. I'm listening to it, and I'm like, no, that's not even how it goes. You're missing the second beat. No, that's not it.
Oh, it's so funny.
I didn't know his name. It was either DeVito or Davido. Like, I still don't. Also, never heard that name. If it's a name, it's a name. But I've never heard it. I mean, they did hire one, Latin American Hispanic person in the movie. His name was Pedro. He was like the first one to fucking
Pedro.
Die. But that happened. But yeah, so they had one. They were like, well, we got one, so we'll hire the rest of the Italians to fill in the rest of it.
Well, I said, this was the director's son, so I figured this was just his way of getting his son into it. Now, his son only ever appeared in The Cremators, so this is it, his two performances. But it's just so funny. It's like, you know, I don't know if you noticed, but he's supposed to be some kind of, I mean, you know, he's playing guitar, and he's very creative, and he's carving things at one point. You know,
Let's talk about the carving.
One of my favorite moments comes where he's talking, you know, the doctor Torres is talking to him. He says, wow, you're quite creative and you're quite good. And they show it on camera, and it's this indistinct blob that I couldn't tell anything about. It was ridiculous.
He did this with a knife to get like just like a dent, and then he was just like, all right, two slits for eyes. Look at my talent.
God, it's so beautiful. I've never seen anything like this in all my life.
He sacrifices it to the creature at the end. He's like,
it's very symbolic.
The creature would want to have this.
And it's like flowing in the water.
Like, looks up and is like, what is this? Why?
I mean, he may as well have taken a knife and just, you know, put a little hole for eyes, a little slash for a nose, a little slash for a mouth, smiling, and that was it.
I mean, it wasn't even smooth, guys.
It was
a wooden carving. It was so choppy.
You know, and, you know, that character does a number of things. Like, you know, he's the one who crawls through the caves and helps them out. And, you know, it's clear I think he was trying to give his son this heroic, you know, wonderful role. And it just didn't work.
I thought it was the opposite. See, I was waiting the whole movie that he was actually some Italian spy, and he was actually in cahoots with the creature and was the one that was like trying to like, and I was waiting for the twist. I mean, I'm like here for it. I'm like, let's go.
He was shady as hell.
He was. Oh, yeah.
Always something I didn't trust off him. About him, for real.
And, you know, I was showing this to my friend Gary, and we were fixated on the man's nose. And I know that's a terrible, terrible thing.
No, the whole thing. It's so pointy and just
it
like...
It looked like a plastic surgery disaster. You know, it was just strange. And the way it was shot, it just made his face, you know, stand out even more.
They decided not to put makeup on it. It was just shining in every shot, like a beacon.
But they gave him, like, black eyes, I noticed. Like, under his eyes, he had, like, really dark bags, and it was clearly, like, there with makeup, and it was kind of weird. I was like, is he just very tired?
Look, clearly, we're not understanding. This definitely has some sort of ecological message. There's an environmental message to his character and his nose, and we just don't understand it. That's our failing, and we shouldn't blame the movie.
That's right. I mean, he was probably exhausted after all that crawling through caves and all that carving, you know?
Wouldn't you be?
That's right. It's well, no skin off my nose. Sorry. Okay.
Much to that point of this being an eco film, I stand by my statement that it really was the anthropologist or the doctor who was the bad guy. To me, I felt like Octoman was just going about his business, trying to protect his babies, and people are just snatching them up, cutting slits into them, and the only time that he ever interacts with anybody, the very first time, is because they attacked his young.
Right, right, right.
To me, I guess what I had connected is that the lead female character was being taken by Octoman because he needed someone to mother his young. And that would be the only reason I could see behind it. Everything was justified, every attack. I feel like the bad guys were the humans in this one.
Are you mean the baby murderers? That the bad guys were the baby murderers?
Yeah.
I'm with you.
Oh, dude, live vivisection of the little Octo buddies? Come on.
They didn't try to like put them out humanely. Like they didn't try to kill the babies humanely. They just take a knife and then just start incising, like just without.
Now,
yeah. I've never.
He looked at him in the eye and like smiled. And
I've never said this before, like, and I hate to say it, but it would have like done my heart some good if they had just hit it over the head with a hammer. Like, at least kill the thing first.
Would just somebody torture you while I dissect you?
Fortunately, these are incredibly fake-looking pieces of plastic with, again, eyes that never blink and mouths that never move. And if you see, there's at one point where it's kind of crawling. And if you look carefully, you can see strings are attached to the legs and they're like pulling them like one on one and then the other one to make it look like it's moving. So
and I would actually like to point out that octopus character as the standout acting performer.
Well, the two other actors I did want to mention, first we have Johnny Caruso, who the circus guy, the guy who keeps wanting to bring back a half man, half fish. That's what he keeps saying. He's played by Jerome Gardino, who was in a whole bunch of TV things in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. Though the two things he's probably most famous for are the very, very unfortunately titled movie Jailbait Babysitter in 1977 and Tarantula Deadly Cargo. And I can see the look of shock on your face, but it turns out Jailbait Babysitter.
I didn't hear anything you said after Jailbait Babysitter. I really didn't.
Well, it turns out that that's one of those films that has an extremely lurid title, but the film itself has almost nothing in it. It's like, you know, title only. It's an extremely tame, boring film.
Well, I'm glad that you let us know and that you investigated that for science.
Absolutely. Well, I couldn't let a title like that go by without poking it. I mean, it's ridiculous. And he was in a whole bunch of other TV things as well. But he's sort of playing the slimy Carl Denham character from like King Kong, you know. He's just looking to bring back Octo as a sideshow freak so he can make some money off of him. And I guess he's supposed to be the villain, but you're right, the scientists are pretty villainous themselves. And finally, there's the Octoman himself. So the suit was designed by, let's see here, George Barr, but it was created, the concept and everything was physically created by Rick Baker, who of course won Academy Awards for his special effects for things like, American Werewolf in London, and you know, just a whole bunch of stuff. And inside the suit was an actor by the name of Reed Morgan. So he's the guy who's walking around and slapping people silly with his octo arms. And he might as well have been like a wrestler, because that's what he kind of reminded me of. He reminds me of a Japanese film that came out in, I think, 2010, 2011, called The Calamari Wrestler, which is, yeah, a Japanese wrestler who turns into a squid and wrestles people and beats them up.
I have not seen this.
I can share this with you. It's a wonderful movie. But that's what it reminded me of so much. And it's just
funny. Like, I mean, you know how hard it is to bench press a person above you and then toss them? He wrestled. He did that with an alligator, too. He's strong.
Yes,
man.
Yes. And it, of course, for those folks who haven't seen this, it's an extremely obvious dummy and an extremely obvious fake plastic gator.
Wait, what?
Yeah.
Octoman was making.
Adorable.
Well, I mean, the baby Octababies, can I call them that? They were making like mewing noises.
Yes.
Which was really strange, because I mean, to my understanding, octopuses don't exactly like make noises, but like,
or live in fresh water.
You know what, we had a discussion about that. Very strange and rare, but not really happen a lot.
I mean they can like flow in from the ocean, but they'll die pretty quick.
Yeah,
that's how that works. Unless of course, wait, we forgot, unless there's radioactivity, because
right, pollution,
and there you go,
and then you get freshwater octopuses. How that happens. But yeah, so I found that it was really interesting that like they had a conversation in the script somewhere where the man was talking to the Octababy and asking like whether it was a girl or a boy, and it was seemingly responding to him in a series of mewing noises.
Right.
Like, are you a little girl? And it'd be like, meow. It was strange. Beautiful. And it was very beautiful. Very beautiful. Yeah. I guess they also developed vocal folds in their time with the radiation.
Right. And to me, the reason that the whole thing is even in there, I think, is a very, very clumsy way of trying to make us, the audience, you know, feel sorry for these poor octo baby plastic toy things.
Well, they're not gonna fool me like that. I love them because they were adorable.
I mean, yes, we love octopus.
Sure. But I mean, that's the trigger that sets Octoman, you know, off. You know, he becomes the great revenge device, because they're poking and prodding and cutting up his little octo buddies, and he's not standing for that shit. So he goes in there and starts to slap the living crap out of everybody. It even gets to the point where, you know, they, for whatever reason, I don't know why they go crawling around in that stupid cave. I never figured that out.
I thought the movie was over, and then there was a cave.
Right. It's like, well, let's pad this out 15 minutes, and so we'll throw them in a cave. So that's what they do, and he's in the cave, and then he's not in the cave, and then when they finally get out of the cave and they find the RV, he pops out of the RV because he's been laying in wait, and starts to slap the shit out of him again.
Why are lights his only weakness if he can survive in daylight? If he's up to the- Isn't the sun just the strongest light? What would it
happen? Yeah. There are a number of inconsistencies and continuity errors, especially on the day and night mix up for the shooting scene. When you guys said the cinematography looked good, I'm thinking about all the times I couldn't remember if it was daylight or night or
right. We didn't say the internet was mixed up.
And then it rained, and the rain like revived it somehow, and then it escaped. Net, and it's like the ground is like dusty and completely dry, like it totally has not rained there.
And how about that extremely clever way of knocking him out by taking the time to run out, get a can of gasoline, pour a circle around him, light it on fire, run in and grab Peter Angeli's character and drag her ass out of there, And then set her on fire.
They're just going to leave her in there? They're going to leave her in the ring of fire?
Yeah, I don't want her to suffocate.
Like, who cares? Like, it's not going to do anything. And then they're like, it's going to deprive him of all oxygen. And I went, how?
It's like,
how anything works.
There's oxygen above him, like an infinity's worth. I know, it was so silly. Oh, my God. Yeah, ridiculous. And it's you know, that's all the screenplay. That's all the ridiculous screenplay. And it was just badly thought out. And, you know, I kind of wish Lenore had been around to see this one. She's our resident scientist. She ended up going back to North Carolina. But I'm sure she would have a lot of things to say about this film, as you guys did as well. It's just ridiculous.
And yeah, from an ecological standpoint, I'm really curious as to why even bother extracting this mutant-like creature if they weren't posing any kind of threat immediately to the environment, you know, other than just sheer vanity. I mean, it's a lot like a really failed rewriting of Jaws, mm-hmm. You know?
Right.
The credit of the film, even though it's trying to present like an ecological like threat to humanity, if we use radiation, it's going to make strange monsters and stuff. There's still a story of his son is in the film, and he said, my grandmother said that my grandfather was attacked and killed by him. So actually, it turns out that a much longer time ago, the creature had already been there.
Sure.
So sure. I found that to be really interesting, because apparently, like, his grandfather died when he was a very young man from the hands of Octoman.
Or the slapping arms of Octoman.
Before the environmental, like, you know, interference of humans, because we're talking about, like, maybe some 50 years ago, that he was already there.
Well, if it's 30 years ago, then it could all be, like, the nuclear bomb testing that was being, you know, done for the Manhattan Project that could have, like, affected things.
That's an interesting story. Like, if you really wanted to incorporate, like, something, a very important environmental message, tie it into that. You know, that's legit, even.
Sure. I mean, they could have actually done a little more research and a little more thought behind everything there, just a bit. But, you know, it wasn't as like, in your face as, say, the message in Birdemic. You guys have seen Birdemic, right? You need to see Birdemic. That's a sort of over the top. The birds are killing us because the environment and global warming and blah 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 blah.
It has to do with the pandemic of birds. Am I right?
And that's what's making the birds flying down out of the sky and exploding like bombs. It's so ridiculous. You have to see this. Yeah. It's brilliant. So it's not quite as in your face ridiculous as that. But like I said, had they put a bit more, you know, oomph into the message, it might have actually made a point or two. But if you're trying to make the creature or the little octo people sort of sympathetic, you know, why is he on a rampage running around killing people 30 years ago?
Exactly. You
know? Well, we don't know his uncle. His uncle might have been a man full of sin.
That's true.
Listen, we don't know this.
Well, I guess that's why it makes me wonder if it's more to do with just like the legend of the area as much as it is about pollution or human interference with nature, which seems to be kind of like the intention of the film, is that it's our fault. We brought this on ourselves. And it's like, but how though?
To the great Mexican folklore of the octopus freshwater people.
Who's enraged by the Mexican hat dance song. But here's the other thing too. They could have just simply left. There was no reason they could have stayed there. They could have just left, and the movie would have just ended, and nobody would have died, and everything would have been fine.
And they would not have further interfered with nature.
Right. And that's the whole message, is like, man interfering with nature. Well, sure, if you stay there and keep saying, we shouldn't be interfering with nature. Let's stay here and interfere more with nature so we can figure out why interfering with nature is bad.
And risk, like, destroying the total ecosystem of the area by killing some, you know, like, a creature that might be killing off pests for, like, people that live there that could be dangerous to them, you know, or, you know, creatures that kill, like, carry diseases and things like that.
Are you saying, like, the Octoman is a common house fighter that it's taking care of?
Basically, in some respects, yeah. In some respects, I mean, that's the importance of an ecosystem, though, is that, you know, everything kind of has its place. And, you know, when there's like an invasion, which they sort of made it seem like an invasion, because what, you know, essentially Octoman was kind of traveling around and following them, but the babies were sort of everywhere. And so I couldn't understand, is Octoman traveling like with his brood, or are these just other ones that are just going throughout this whole water system that they're traveling along? Yet another question involving that, and it sort of tells me that, you know, even if Octoman was finished at the end of the film, there's still so much, or so many more of the same species that are out there. So right. this is a film you can't really tell the story of until you actually, like, you know, you've either killed them all, or maybe there's a sequel somewhere.
And well, then they dirty, taking him out at the end. I was like, he trusted you. He trusted you. How could you do him like that? Dishonor. Dishonor.
Yeah, that was rough. But, you know, clearly they did not put a whole lot of thought behind this film. And like I said,
empathy.
This was just basically like a retelling or a modern, quote unquote, readaptation of Creature of the Black Lagoon. And he just wanted to make it for this ridiculous octopus thing because he just thought it would be terrifying. He really did. And it's gotta be ecologically involved because that's the thing right now. And it's gotta pick up the girl and wander around with it because that's what wandering monsters do. They pick up the girl and wander around with her. Everybody's guess is as good as mine as to what exactly is gonna happen with the girl.
It's usually a justification. Usually.
But yeah, and it's interesting because you notice at one point where he's been slapping the shit out of somebody and she decides to make him go away. She's like, stop, or back, he says. And that's all she says, just like over and over and over. And finally he's like, okay, you know, and just wanders off.
Argument.
That's because she herself is a light.
I see.
She stands for the people that clean up trash at the beach and then post it on Instagram to get likes. That's what she stands for, I believe. I think that's the parallel here between her and those people. That's what it is.
At the same time, she could have done that when she was wandering around with her and just said, let me go, instead of shooting him in the gut.
Well, you know, what was kind of cool that I really was hoping was sort of going to come to pass is that in the beginning, like when she would go out to the areas by herself and just kind of space out, it almost looked like she was being hypnotized by it or whatever. And so like later on, she has a line where she says something like, I've never seen it as my enemy, you know, and the guy calls it enemy. And then she says that and I'm like, is he in her head though? Because like that would be really cool. Like he was capable of hypnotizing them and then like, or something, and then, or communicating. Like on a cerebral level, you know, without words.
You know,
so that could have been.
I had this really fantasy where that. She just takes him by one of his eight hands and just sort of walks off into the sunset and they live happily ever after. And, you know, they're taking care of the little octo babies. And here's the thing about the octo babies. Are they like little octomen, you know, in waiting? Are they going to grow up to become octomen?
I have genuine concerns for the well-being of the people who do not live there.
The semi-sentient creatures that they were just murdering.
Yeah.
Right.
Because there were so many of them. There were at least
wherever this place was.
Right. But there's at least three babies that we were made privy to that survived. Mm. And they either were continually traveling with Octoman or they were presenting themselves as already existing in the spaces that everyone moved to. So there's either a ton of them, but even if there's not a ton of them, I mean, one Octoman is like a lot to deal with. So if you've got three Octobabies out there that will potentially be Octoman man. You know, like that's a pretty scary like prospect.
Sure. Especially when you've got an enraged Octoman who's slapping people left and right constantly. The thing never slept. I mean, he was just always enraged or he's stalking somebody. You know, there's a lot of shots of it in the water, sort of moving through the reeds. Even if none of the characters are near the water, they just kept letting you know that it was around and it was going to come get you at some point.
They paid a lot
for that suit. They wanted to get the most they could out of it.
He kind of had some Neeson vibes, you know? He was like, you know, they messed with his kids, so he found them, you know?
He had a particular set of skills, and that was slapping people around.
I mean, he could be slapping.
I will say the attention to detail that suction cups really would kind of, like, rip at the skin. Like, the only thing that there was attention to detail on in the entire film, but at least it was there.
I mean, there's a reason for it. Like, the point, there's a point where a guy gets killed by the trailer and, like, half of his face is, like, kind of ripped off or whatever.
Prosthetics and that's kind of
nice. And, yeah, there are definitely, like, suction cup attacks, like, all over their bodies and wounds.
And at least on one instance, he uses his tentacle as, like, a pokey thing and stabs someone. Did you see that? He, like, kind of stabs them with his tentacle, and it kind of goes into their chest, and he dies. And I was like, wow, that's pretty impressive.
That's pretty, yeah, that's one way to handle business.
And I love, too, how sometimes he would just kind of shake his fist, or, you know, he didn't have a fist, but he sort of had a fist, and he would shake, and then the other arms that were all tied to it would shake. And it was just so funny, you know, the body language of the guy in the suit. Clearly, he wasn't thinking, you know, I should act like an octopus. He was thinking, I should act like a guy in an octopus suit because I don't know any better. He was
thinking, holy shit, it's 98 degrees and I'm wearing this gigantic suit. I think that's what he was thinking.
Right. I'm sure that was a very uncomfortable suit. I would love to interview the guy. I don't think anybody is alive still involved with that movie, but if I could come up.
So it did kill everybody. So we were right. It did kill everybody.
Right. If anybody, if I could find out a way to interview them, I would love to find out about this, or, you know, maybe somewhere there's a director's cut with commentary. I would love to see that. So I think I mentioned before we started recording that there was a 40th anniversary issue put out by Fred Olen Ray and Bayview Entertainment. And what happened is apparently there was an actor called Ross Hagen who was in just a ton of B movies and independent movies back in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And I guess he had a bunch of films, and this is one of the movies he had. And I guess he was selling it, and Fred Olen Ray bought his entire library, and he, yeah, and that group, Bayview Entertainment, have been putting out these films. And so that's really where you can get this film is this 40th anniversary widescreen print, special print. And apparently it looks really good. They cleaned up a bunch of stuff. I mean, who wouldn't want to see this in Blu-ray? Come on.
In high def? Oh, my God. Sign me up. So How much?
Oh, it's expensive. It was on Amazon. I saw it for like $200. So it ain't cheap. It's for serious, you know, it's crap hounds only. But I mean, just imagine you get to see that suit in all of its glory, all the details of that ridiculous suit. You know, the eyes that never blink, the mouth that never closes. It's, oh my goodness.
Speaking of the eyes that never blink, something that kind of got us during the film was the fly-like view that you would get from the POV of Octoman.
What, he had like cat-like eyes. Like, I don't understand why he had like fly-like vision with cat-like eyes.
I know. I don't quite understand that either. I don't understand how that would help you living under the water looking for fish or whatever. That's just going to make it even worse.
When you're looking at lights to make them pretty, because it was like a kaleidoscope, so that would help. Oh, but wait, light, his only weakness.
Oh, there's that, yeah.
Right, mm-hmm. The flashlight especially. And it was like, you know, a 2-volt battery flashlight too.
Environment.
Ah, flashlights. Yes, the light from flashlights is bad for the environment. I read that somewhere on the internet. Somewhere.
And he got shot several times, and he didn't seem to, you know, that didn't seem to bother him too much.
Until the last one, it was the shot of betrayal that killed him. He really, truly died of a broken heart.
That's what it was.
Well, but did he die, though? He kind of went back into the water and went underwater. Maybe he's gone back to heal just so he can come back and slap people again.
The betrayal, and then after he saw Davido's wood carving, he gave up on life.
Well, that I understand, but yeah, he did, I'm sure, felt the sting of betrayal. And the extra rubbing the salt in the wound with that stupid carving that didn't look like anything.
That's what it looked like. I'll be back when I lose 10 pounds.
I don't understand how you shoot something like 6 times, it doesn't die. And you're like, hold on, guys, we got a net. Let's just put it on the net. We're not going to tie him up or anything like that. Just lightly drape the net over him. I think he's cold. Let's put this mattress-like net on
him. We want him to be comfortable. We want to respect the environment.
Right. And they were drugging him because, of course, they have drugs that work on octopus mutants. Who doesn't have that sitting in their collection. And then the rain wakes him up, something like that.
It revives him.
Revives him.
Once he was depleted of so much water, of having been out of the water for too long.
Right.
Then rain brought him back. That seemed to be because there was a point where it was yelled across the campsite as if it were common knowledge. The rain seems to have revived him.
Right.
And it was like, oh, yeah, of course, of course. It rained. I heard thunder at one point. I thought it was the creature making the noise.
And right, I was like, I don't right. know.
Yeah, there's a point when the creature's breathing and you hear like some rattling and stuff, and almost he almost sounds more like a motorcycle.
My favorite question about this film is, what exactly is Octoman going to do with Pier Angeli's character? He's carrying her, but to where and to what end? Is there going to be some octo smooching going on here? Is there going to be some heavy eight-arm petting?
I believe that he was trying to bridge the gap between man and octopus, and he was trying to get assistance in raising his younglings. I mean, it's just the 1970s way of imposing more emotional labor on a woman than is necessary.
I mean, Bobby, what do you think? I mean, is this the way you pick up a chick in the 70s? Is this it?
I mean, it works better than that guy saying you should be in the kitchen. Like, at least he was kind of romantic. Like, trying to carry her over the threshold.
That weird cowboy.
Like, that comment just came like out of nowhere. He was like, oh, there's a woman around. Time to yell something misogynistic. Make sure everyone knows there's a man in the room.
Ridiculous. Well, at least...
I'm just saying she could have done worse than Octoman in this film, I guess is my point.
But I appreciate that moment because she looked over at him like, really, bitch? And then she just got up and she's like, you know what? Maybe I choose death today. And then she decides...
And here's part of the problem, at least with her character. What does she do? What exactly is her job?
I understand that she's engaged to the doctor based on a previous conversation when he visits the lab in the earlier part of the movie.
But why is she there? What function does she serve? She's only there to be upset with a stupid octopus man. That's it.
Well, she's really good at staring off into lakes. So
that's true.
You need somebody to do
that. I was hoping she'd be able to interpret what Octoman was saying. I was really hoping out.
You know what she was needed for? Back.
Yeah. Because, you know, typically,
she's the medium.
Typically, when you have these movies from the 50s and 60s, you know, the female character is usually there. Oh, the homemaker, she's making lunch, she's making dinner, you know, that kind of a thing. She's taking care of the men. She didn't really do any of that. But she didn't really do anything else useful either, in my opinion. So she was just kind of there.
She was a prop.
Whoa, because back. All right, so back up, because she did this.
That's true.
In a way, she actually saved someone's
life. And she did defeat the villain. Like,
she had the
not the villain. She defeated Octoman. She didn't defeat the villain, which is ultimately, from what I learned from this movie, the patriarchy. But she did defeat Octoman. So, like, that she did those things.
Yeah. She kind of saved everyone. She's sort of a hero of the film.
I know, but she's, you know, that's like her only purpose is to be that. It's like, you know, I wish they had, like, some function for her. She could have been a scientist. Why couldn't she be a scientist? Why couldn't she be like an anthropologist or something? You know, instead of just
Captain America's only ability is to be able to like punch people and take out the villains. You're not a scientist. She's basically what I'm saying is she's Captain America. She Chris Evans is done. Hire her. Wait a minute, we can't. Holy shit, this got dark again.
Well, it's doubly dark when you think, you know, who knows what was going through her brain at this particular time. She may have just gotten through this movie and said, you know what, that's it. If this is what the kind of stuff I'm dealing with from here on out, see ya. I don't know.
Maybe she was just so heartbroken for killing Octoman. She was that method.
There you go. It could very well have been the guilt of betrayal. We'll never know. Okay, so unless you guys have any other questions about this ridiculous, ridiculous monster movie, I guess we've just about come to the time where we have to start talking about our scoring. You guys remember how we score, right?
I do, but remind us.
Okay, so for the benefit of those folks who listen to our show and those who do not, we have a system by which we rank or rate our movies on a scale of 1 to 10. Where 1 is only a little bit of stink, and 10 is a whole big, fat, hairy mountain of stink, and 5 is kind of in between, And if you feel particularly subtle about your rating, you could go a half step, say a 6.5 or a 7.5 or a 2.5 if it floats your boat. And, you know, we total up our scores at the end of the year, and we figure out which movie was the stinkiest film of this particular season. And I'm telling you what, it has been a very odd season. We've had some ridiculously bad films, and we've had some decent films that have actually kind of snuck in there too. We were all kind of surprised. So I'll be very curious to see how you guys rate this film. So I'm going to let you guys go first and kind of maybe explain your scores as you will.
All right. Well, I guess I have to go first. I'm going to go ahead and give it a 3. And
wow.
Its stinkiness comes from mostly the costume. And I hate to say it, but the reason why I'm going to give it a 3 is because I feel like this film takes itself too seriously. If it were a film that was like willing to lean into the ridiculousness of it, understanding that the plot points jump around and that it's not, you know, a serious, intense film, then I might have given it a higher scoring.
But, and remember, a 3 is pretty good. That means there's not a lot of stink to it.
Well, that's what I'm saying. I didn't think there was. I guess for me, when I'm classifying stink, I'm classifying like camp and, you know, effects and things like that.
Okay. But
then I guess by virtue of that, then maybe I should give it a 7.
Okay. Okay. That makes sense.
I think I should go in the opposite direction then. Sorry. I listened to you explain the rating and I went completely in the opposite direction because my brain still has not recovered from watching the film yet and it's not totally reassembled yet.
Well, I kind of figured it because I remember your reaction to Baby Ghost, and this is not the Baby Ghost reaction. You were over the moon for Baby Ghost and the Baby Ghost music and everything. And
Octavia did not have a theme song, so.
Right. This was definitely not the same reaction, so I figured you would have given it a worse score.
Yeah, but honestly, I don't think there was enough stink, personally. I could have used a lot more stink on this film.
But a 7 is where you're going to land?
Yeah, I think so.
Okay, fair enough. All right, Bobby, it's up to you now.
I went back and forth on the film. Like, it kind of started, and I was like, that was kind of the whole movie for me. And, like, I mean, as I was watching, I was like, you know what? This is just kind of, like, middle of the road. Because while there's some things that are absolutely terrible, like the costume and logic and rational thinking, like some things were good. Like some of the shots were framed well. They had some like philosophical lines where I was like, oh, like the locations were, you know, generally pretty. So like, it's just middle of the road for me. I'm gonna go with a 5, like just directly in the middle. Like that's where I'm sitting at.
Okay, that makes sense. I can see people doing that. You know, this is a film that, you know, in my memory, I thought this was a lot worse than when I went back the other night so that I could refresh myself to see it again. And then when I saw it, I'm like, okay, I definitely remember the highlights of why I thought this was a terrible movie. On the other hand, like yourself, there were some other things that were poking at. I'm like, you know, this wasn't quite as bad as I recalled. Yes, the squid suit is ridiculous. Yes, some of the character reactions and some of the things that they do are ridiculous. Yes, some of the concepts, especially the quote-unquote scientific ones, are bogus, ridiculous, and, you know, I mean, I guess if you're eating popcorn and smoking a bowl in the 70s in the drive-in, you're not going to give two thoughts about it. But we have seen worse. I have definitely seen worse. So it's still got a hefty amount of stink to it, but I think I'm going to go with a 7.5. So slightly stinkier than Lila's score. I'm a little less forgiving with some of the bad points than Bobby is, because that suit and then the whole DeVito's character was absurd. I've never seen a more absurd character, you know, paper thin, one-dimensional characterization, you know, in years. Awful. But on the other hand, it's also kind of fun. I like to show this movie to people because who doesn't want to see a ridiculous squid monster wandering around, slapping people with his arms, picking up women and dragging them away to do God knows what? Don't want to know.
I don't want to meet those people.
We're good.
Right. There's probably a slash, you know, story written in there someplace by someone. I don't want to read it. All right. So there you go. Octoman. All right. Any last thoughts about the film?
Yes.
Actually, I do.
Baby ghost, baby Octoman ghost. How about that? Outstanding. So anything that you guys want to let us know as far as what's going on professionally or in your lives or anything like that? Or have you guys kind of come to a halt with COVID?
Oh, no. We've actually been staying in school at the studio mainly, but that's about to come to an end this week. So we'll be finished our first year of Meisner training, which has been really keeping us sane over the process, you know, just having something to do.
Sure.
Know, that can still remain focused on your work and still improving your work and elevating yourself as a performer. And yeah, I've done a little bit of voiceover. I've been doing some auditions with that, you know, something that I can stay at home with. But, you know, I've done some online theater and some fundraisers and stuff like that, which has been really fun. It's been really neat to explore the different facets of using Zoom and the distance, like, performances.
Sure.
I've met some really cool people along the way. So it's actually kind of neat.
Okay. How about yourself, Bobby? Anything to report?
So for anybody who has HBO Max, I did some work on the HA Comedy Festival, or it might be the HA Laugh Festival. I should really know that, having worked on it. But you know, you guys can watch it if you want. But really, I just went all the way to the credit so I could see my name. I'm an associate producer on that project. So that's pretty good.
Outstanding.
I have a lot of other stuff that's actually coming up in the wings. And I wish I could tell you, but I can't. But if you have me on a future show, then I could potentially say it then. It's things that are still in the pipeline, and I can't say anything about them yet.
Well, that would be great. Are you guys interested in coming back and doing a future show?
Only always.
Always.
I promise I will keep you away from the likes of Zombie Cop and keep more into the lines of Baby Ghost / Octoman, because there's just a million billion different movies out there. My personal library of stink is just grows exponentially daily. You know, I do, I don't know if you noticed, but I do these haul videos every month, and I talk about the latest thing. I mean, this month I've got like 28 new movies that I'm getting. So, you know, it's just a never ending barrel of stuff out there, and I've yet to touch bottom. And we will be wrapping up season 3 of Indie Film Cafe. We've also been doing Indie Film Cafe Spotlight. I don't know if you've been seeing that, but we've been talking to some of the people who make these movies, directors and writers and actors, and we've been trying to sort of talk to them. So we did Kevin Strange, who did all the Hack movies. That's coming out, I think, on Friday. And then I can't divulge who we have next on our list, but as far as B-movie directors go, he's probably one of the biggest and brightest names out there. So that announcement will be coming out soon. I don't want to take the glory away from Moody, because he did all the work and he's going to enjoy announcing that, but that's coming up. I do have another podcast, a new podcast that's going to be coming out soon with Rebecca Reinhart. She's one of the actresses and producers. She's in The Embalmers, and she's been involved in some of Moody's stuff, Supernatural Assassins and such. We're going to be sort of making fun. It's called a Sexploitation Sleaze Cast. And we're going to be looking at things like really, really, really bad porn movies and weird monster movie / porn mashups and weird artsy films that just have a whole bunch of strange nudity and strange sexual stuff going on. Because there really isn't anyone talking about that kind of weirdness. And as usual, I have a little bit of everything out there. So, you know, and it was difficult finding somebody else to actually talk about that stuff too. And here's Rebecca, who's like, oh yeah, I watch all that crap too. So I was like, I always like to have a female voice to bounce it off of, because, you know, me and Nerdy, we got the nerdy white guy voice going on. We would really need to have some more diversity. So it was kind of a coup to run into Rebecca Reinhart. So that should be coming out hopefully in October at some point. And then, of course, we do have the ongoing project with the Supernatural Assassins. You know, we've been flooding Facebook for that, and You know, Moody's, you know, over his head trying to juggle all that stuff out there where you guys are in LA. So there's a lot of stuff going on. And but I'm very, very glad that I was able to get you two folks back, because, you know, I know there are people out there that listen to the show and they're like, so whatever happened to Lyle and Bobby from the season one episode or season three, first episode? Where did they go? You know, I know you came back for the Moody episode, but that wasn't necessarily the greatest or most fun film, because that got roundly pilloried, and it deserved it. It was a terrible movie. So I hope this one was a little bit more fun for you guys.
Yes. And I mean, look, anything's a step up from Zombie Cop. Jesus, that's... Oh, boy.
I hear you.
Any kind of scary movie, the stinkier the better, as far as I'm concerned. Yeah. I really enjoy it. So I appreciate you having me on again, because it's been a blast.
Yay. Well, I'm glad. And yeah, we will definitely do this again. All right. So from the East Coast and with Continuity Monkey here, I will say toodaloo to everybody. Thanks again for coming on the show. And we will see you guys next time. Bye
bye.
Bye.
How do you stop recording? Oh, there we go.